This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Christina Thomas. This spring marks the 30th anniversary of the release of a film that was the introduction, for many, to the concept of the internet. War Games hit theaters on June 3, 1983, and provided a scary premise. A teenager accidentally brings the world to the brink of global nuclear war. In her new book, Cached, Decoding the Internet in Global Popular Culture, Stephanie Ricker-Schulte explores how films, news media, and other sources help shape the direction of the internet and the World Wide Web. Stephanie, an assistant professor of communication at the University of Arkansas, recently spoke to Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums about the book and about how War Games and other films of the era directed popular opinions about the emerging digital world.
A lot of researchers have sort of talked about the internet as having two parents, as having this parent in the military, which, you know, makes a lot of sense because the internet was funded by NASA funding. So the same funding packet that funded NASA funded the internet. And then also its second parent being the counterculture. So the 70s and 80s counterculture, hippies really were the cultural arm of the internet. And War Games really shows you those two sides in a kind of powerful way.
And War Games and then some other images that came up that were often used not just by the entertainment industry, but sometimes the nightly news and the news weeklies showed the protagonists or the people who are with computers as sort of outsiders, messy bedrooms, this sort of idea that not quite could be trusted. Because as you said, computers weren't really in the homes yet, let alone the office.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, the computers were mostly used by teenagers in basements playing video games and used for entertainment purposes at that point. And I think that's part of the reason why it was sort of menacing in some ways. We connected it to changing of the guard fears about kids these days, right? And, you know, merged those with fears that we had about Cold War, and evils lurking.
And War Games was screened, or at least part of it was screened on the Senate floor?
Yeah, in committee. Yeah, the first legal policies about the internet happened in the wake of that movie, and it was the Computer Fraud Act, which is the policy that was recently used to indict Aaron Schwartz, and the senators were responding to a number of hacks that happened, and they actually watched War Games as part of research, which I thought was quite fascinating. That was actually one of the sparks for writing the whole book, was actually making that discovery and realizing that had happened.
And a lot of those policies are still kind of the policies that are on the books now.
Yeah, they are. It was the precedent policy, the very first policy. And really what happened was that, you know, hacking became a problem, and Congress felt that it needed to respond to that problem, and it had a wide array of choices, of different ways it could respond. It could respond with punitive action, like jail time and fines.
Some of the legislation that did not come bills was very severe.
Yeah, which involved jail time.
Yeah.
Or it could be as light as an ethics class or something really light. And, you know, I argue that, you know, part of the reason why that legal decision went toward the sort of parental way was because we imagine the internet itself as teenaged and as populated by teenagers. So it was varying layers of teenagerdom.
What was the internet World's Fair in 1996? What was this? I don't remember this either.
The Internet World's Fair was an international collaboratory event that basically took the idea of the World's Fair and took it online. So countries had representative websites where they placed their most compelling internet artifacts on there. And then citizens also participated, which was sort of a new offering for a World's Fair. And it ended up resulting in a lot of real tangible results. So we got infrastructure got a lot better in the wake of that, kind of the same way that the World's Fairs have rippled through technology and passed in their physical forms.
And it really set up this sort of dual way of looking at the internet and the World Wide Web in that, okay, it's a global community, but it was still seen as a U.S.-based sort of thing because it's happening in Central Park. So there was this sort of, is it global or is it global but with a U.S. leadership?
Yeah, a lot of what I write about in the book is about the ways that American culture has rippled through the internet and the ways that, you know, for example, the United States government has .gov, is its domain name. Every other country has .uk for the United Kingdom or .de for Germany, but we're .gov, right? We get to be the universal access. We're the internet's government in some ways. And that's part of because we invented it and began it, although it was international very few years after it was invented, 3 years after it was invented. But we have sort of become the cultural, the dominant cultural power on the internet, and it means Americanness in some ways. And so in that World's Fair in particular, the gateway to the World's Fair was through Central Park, which was, I thought, a fitting metaphor for the ways that it was American and is still imagined as this American thing.
Did you found that the way national and international media look at and described the internet and the World Wide Web to sort of evolve over time, because there slowly becomes this inclusion. And I don't think you could probably find that in the auto industry or something like that. But it is interesting because it's relatively recently to see how quickly we sort of went from articles in Life magazine about the dangers of the teenage hacker to sort of the internet and the web are part of everyday life. And it really, it seems like in the 1990s, explodes in how newspapers and news magazines cover the internet.
Yes, that's the moment when I say it kind of moves out of the teenager's bedroom and into the office. And we start thinking about the internet as something that will help us economically. So we start thinking about it as less of a toy and more of an economic driver or a means to efficiency. And it's also when we start to panic a little bit and start to think about it as a new frontier that we need to settle. So that's when Al Gore famously enters into the conversation in a way that has been terribly mischaracterized, the poor guy. But he, you know, we really start to think about it as the key to the future and the key to our economic future, our social future, and that trend has continued now, and we continue to talk about it that way as this sort of inevitable angel of history that's pulling us forward.
You know, I don't remember my first ever interaction with either the web or the internet, but I do remember seeing a commercial for Tide, and at the bottom of the commercial, they didn't say it, the narrator didn't say it, but at the bottom it said, learn more at www.tide.com. I thought, what? No way that this is ever going to be so important that people would want to find out about laundry detergent. I couldn't understand why Tide had a presence on the web. Do you remember your first interaction with the web?
I do remember it, actually. It was with Debbie Lieber, now Debbie Deer, who's a local doctor. And it was in her living room, actually. Her father had been had an important role in developing computing technology, actually. And so she was sort of an early adopter family in Fayetteville, from what I could tell. And we got online, and she was a mutter. So she played games online. They were textual games. And I remember it was this sort of late 80s, maybe, mid-80s, late 80s. And I remember looking over her shoulder and watching her traverse this amazingly complicated game from my perspective, and I didn't understand how it worked. And so I kept asking her these questions about, you know, what are you doing? What is this text? Who are these people? Where are they? I couldn't understand how the system worked. And she was sort of irritated by those questions. And I think that was the first time that I realized that she had entered a new state of being and with a new set of assumptions about this online space that I didn't yet have access to.
Well, that's analogous to what was happening around the world. You had these people who knew, and you had these those of us who didn't, and there was hardly any room in between, it seemed. Either you were in or you weren't.
Right, yeah. And the same thing happens now with new technologies, right? As they ripple through, you've got the diffusion processes as they ripple through. And, you know, somebody that you know gets the new technology, and then it feels okay for you to have it, right? It gives you access through someone else. And Debbie was my early adopter.
There are film depictions of the internet as you move into the 90s and people's interaction with computers that are quite different. I remember Sandra Bullock in The Net, and that was a scary sort of tale because her identity was stolen. You mention in the book that there are a couple of James Bond movies where the villain wants to take over internet and web access. And then there's this German movie that I can't do the German name, but it translates to Half the Rent. And that idea is of a protagonist who's taking himself already in the mid-90s, something you hear people talk about now, taking himself offline. He wasn't going to live on a computer or a cell phone anymore. Was there a sort of difference, am I being too broad, between European and U.S. entertainment's approach to the web in the 90s?
Yes, there was. And, you know, that was part of what I found. I mean, just like back in the early days when I was thinking, was sitting next to Debbie and watching her online, I wanted to think about the ways that we were thinking about technologies and the way other people thought about them differently. And so when I started watching film and reading websites and reading reviews and reading articles from other countries, I started to realize that I had innate American biases about what technology is and what it was for and what it would do to us and why we should use it. And Germany in particular, there were all of these cases in which people were choosing to not use the internet. And that seemed so foreign to me as an American. And I started looking at American films and I realized that, you know, in American films, you win in the contest by either controlling the internet or controlling technology or dominating somebody else through it, right? Mm-hmm. And in other places, you win by not being connected, by disconnecting. So it would be like as at the end of The Matrix, if Neo decided to go offline, then he just no longer was, instead of, you know, flexing the internet the way he does,
right.
He would just disconnect from it. And I thought that was a fascinating idea, to think about technology as a choice, which we don't really do. We think about it as an inevitability and not really as a choice.
You write in the conclusion that history doesn't neatly repeat itself. But you come back to WikiLeaks and Adrian Assange, and there are, to the layman, you can make these connections back to the Matthew Broderick character to some degree. Is this a sort of youngster creating havoc for havoc's sake, or unwittingly creating some havoc? And some of the portrayals in the news media were eerily similar.
They were, and I thought that WikiLeaks was a nice place to end, because the conversations that we had when we talked about WikiLeaks, when we were trying to figure out what it did or didn't do or offered us, we really did revisit a lot of those conversations. Conversations about teenagedom, about virtual realities, about global space, about the roles of government and corporations, about liberation and transparency and democracy, and all of those different metaphors that I talk about are sort of revisit. And I think that's the way we operate. As technology continues to develop, we revisit the different ideas that we've had in the past, and we try and anchor them somehow in the current moment.
I think back to every prediction I read in the 80s and 90s, usually in Newsweek or on the nightly news, about what this burgeoning sort of technology would mean. And I didn't believe any of them. I didn't believe that we would get our plane tickets online. I didn't believe that music would be available online. I just never believed it. Do you ever let yourself think about what this might be in 15 or 20 years? And is it even possible?
That's what my next book is about.
Oh, well, then it is.
Yeah, so I obsess about the future. I obsess about wearable technology, about embodied technology, about, you know, Google Glasses and the future of that, and nanobots as big as blood cells, correcting all of the cancer cells in our body. I obsess about LCD contact lenses in a way that is
I don't know
very
what
nerdy.
LCD contact lenses
it
are.
It gives readings of your body. So, like, it might measure the blood sugar of your body and an alarm would go off. Or
holy cow.
But so I think about a lot about the ways that we are embodying technology and technology is embodying us, right? We're both escaping into technologies and surfing into virtual realities more, but we're also wearing it in our bodies in new ways, and both of those things are happening together. So the next book that I'm writing back about is about the singularity, which is the moment when humans and machines merge, which I think is at 2045. That's when that happens. So you have a little bit of time, but buckle up.
Stephanie Ricker-Schulte is an assistant professor of communication at the University of Arkansas and author of the new book, Cached, Decoding the Internet and Global Popular Culture. There is more from her conversation with Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums at our website, ozarksatlarge.com.